Hello there, and welcome to the Joyfully Black Podcast, where we have candid conversations with Black women on nourishing their mental well-being while balancing career, family life, and community care. I'm your host, Joy Dixon, a public health professional turned woman in tech and lover of seeing people thrive in their zone of genius. I hope you all enjoyed today's episode. And guess what? I have something special in the works for April 27th, 2024. That's right, of this year. So go ahead, save the date. Joyfully Black is going to be having another in-person event in partnership with another dynamic organization. I cannot wait to announce the details. So stay tuned and stay posted to IG, social media, and your inbox for more details. Talk to you soon. Hey, y'all. I am super excited about today's episode because at the time of recording, we are in March, which is Sleep Awareness Month. And let's be real. How many of us can admit that we wear the amount of things we can get done on little sleep as a badge of honor? Or maybe tends to scroll online instead of finally getting to sleep, or maybe just opts to try to squeeze in one last project before letting yourself rest. And then, of course, we have some of our other friends who can go to sleep at the drop of a dime. Yeah, that's not me, but I definitely know people that love getting their naps in. At any rate, even if you are a person who can easily go to sleep or simply can't get to bed at a decent hour, this episode is for you. And in recent months, I have really just been on this journey to pay closer attention to sleep hygiene as a part of my own self-care practice. And frankly, after speaking with today's guest, I'm really encouraging others to do the same. In today's episode, I just wanted to go ahead and give a heads up because we are diving deep into the world of sleep health, its major impact on health outcomes, and solutions for a better night's rest. So in today's episodes, we're going to tackle some common misconceptions about sleep and share resources for those who are looking to improve their sleep routine. Now, I gotta tell you, your girl loves to nerd out on some public health things, so there are some moments when we get a little scientific, but overall, I just really enjoyed the relatable way that our guest, Dr. Dana Johnson, broke things down for us. So whether you are looking to understand more about the science of sleep, really find practical advice for improving your sleep health, or trying to understand how sleep apnea and insomnia are really affecting you and your loved ones, this episode has something for you. So really excited for you to join us as we uncover the keys to better sleep and, of course, better health and happiness. So today's guest is a sleep epidemiologist and assistant professor at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University. With a doctorate in epidemiologic science from the University of Michigan and a postdoctoral fellowship at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Dana A. Johnson's research focuses on understanding sleep health disparities. And so this includes things like studying social and environment determinants of sleep disorders, which we'll get into, and then their impact on health outcomes like hypertension, diabetes, and cognition. In fact, Dr. Johnson leads the ARISE study, which examines the link between environmental factors, sleep disruption, and cardiovascular health in 400 Black adults in Atlanta. She also explores interventions for stress reduction and home improvements to improve sleep and reduce health risks, which we all need. With over 100 peer-reviewed publications, she's been featured in various media outlets for her expertise in sleep health. And her mission is to raise awareness about sleep's importance and address sleep health inequities, and exactly why we are so delighted to have Dr. Dana Johnson on the show today. Welcome to Joyfully Black, Dr. Dana.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the invitation and I'm happy to be here.
Wonderful. So I always like to level set for our listeners. Would you share exactly what is a sleep epidemiologist and, you know, how did you get into this journey to sleep health in general?
Yes, great question. And so sleep epidemiology is not a traditional discipline within the epidemiologic field. So a sleep epidemiologist is an epidemiologist who studies trends and the distribution of sleep-related factors So more specifically, I study the reasons or determinants why certain people have sleep disorders and what some of those risk factors may be. And then I also study the contribution of sleep to other health outcomes, mainly in the cardiovascular realm, but I do work within cancer, cognitive decline, and other health outcomes.
Oh, wow. And so what made you get interested in sleep health in general? I mean, because I don't think many people think about their sleep hygiene until they're not sleeping. And so exactly. I'm just really curious, how did you enter into this world?
Yeah. So when I started my doctoral program, I was very much interested in the relationship between neighborhood environment and cardiovascular disease. And I was attending a talk at a conference, and the now head of NHLBI, which is the institute at the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Gary Gibbons, he was giving a talk on stroke among Black individuals. And he had one slide that talked about sleep as a risk factor for stroke. And similar to what you just described, I felt the same way. I never thought about my sleep. It was something that I did, and that was it, right? It was just something I did. And I began to think more about sleep being more than just this activity that we do. And it just really stood out to me. And I began reading more about sleep and its relation to health and how certain groups were more disproportionately affected by poor sleep. I'm from Detroit, Michigan, which is the Motor City. And there's a lot of data. And at the time, it was more so developing about shift workers. So people who work non-traditional hours that may rotate between night shift and day shift. And I thought about my family members and friends who work for manufacturing for the car companies and how they have these rotating shifts and how that likely contributes to some of the health concerns that they were facing. And I decided at that point that I wanted to study this for my dissertation. And then it became my focus for my career.
Oh, wow. That is so fascinating. And you're right. I mean, people don't think about how shift work really affects them, which we'll get into, because I think about, you know, I have family members who were nurses for 30, 40 years. And I would, and, you know, more recent years, I even asked, like, is your sleep still affected by you working like the graveyard shift and things like that? And they're like, oh, yeah, I gained weight. You know, these things happen. And you hear about it all the time. So It's really important work that you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because you'll find people that are now retired, and they can be retired 10, 20 years and have the same sleep schedule that they had when they worked. And whether it's, you know, they worked afternoon shift, so they're used to going to sleep really late. So these are routines and habits and physiologic effects that last over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I would love to hear a little bit before we go into like healthy habits that people can really start to adapt. I would really love to go into some of the basics. And I know when we think about sleep disorders or ways in which people are not sleeping well, we think about like insomnia, of course. People kind of laugh about it now, but it's a real thing. Sleep apnea and even narcolepsy. So what are some of the most common sleep disorders that you see, and how do you see it generally impact people's lives on a day-to-day basis?
Yes. So one of the most common sleep disorders is insomnia, which you mentioned. So insomnia is a sleep disorder in which there's a problem either initiating or staying asleep. And so this, if that occurs for you more than three times a week, you are typically experiencing insomnia symptoms. And it affects about 20 to 30% of our population of U.S. adults. Then another very common sleep disorder is sleep apnea, in which there is typically an obstruction in the airway, which causes someone to stop breathing for at least 10 seconds. And this will happen several times, depending on the severity, per hour during someone's sleep cycle. And so that's sleep apnea. And this is a little bit where the sleep inequities piece comes in. So in general, we see that it's not as common as insomnia, but it affects about, on average, 4 to 5% of the population. But when we look at specific groups like Black or African American adults, we see a much higher prevalence. And so I have a study that we did in Jackson, Mississippi, where we found upwards of 70% of our sample of 1,000 Black adults had at least mild sleep apnea. And so so for those that have moderate or severe, that affects about 30%. And so what that means is at least 15 times per hour of the sleep cycle, someone stops breathing for a short period. And so that's oxygen being cut off from the brain. Typically, there's a level of snorting or snoring that occurs. So really, it's a choking sound that someone makes. And so the person may not know that they're waking up. So if you watch a video, you'll oftentimes see someone wake up and they're choking a little bit and they go back to sleep. So imagine that occurring repeatedly throughout the sleep period. And so the reason why I'm stressing that is because often when we think about sleep disorders, we think about the effect it has at night. So both for sleep apnea and for insomnia, you find that there is a very severe effect that happens during the day. So individuals with untreated insomnia or sleep apnea, they tend to be very sleepy during the day. And so when you have that, you see more more accidents, whether it's occupational, drowsy driving can occur, which is as detrimental as drunk driving. And then there's other long-term consequences that can occur, such as the development of cardiovascular disease, hypertension, diabetes, obesity. And there's even studies that have shown that sleep apnea contributes to overall mortality. So it can increase someone's risk of dying. And so those are the most common sleep disorders. And then there's others that are briefly mentioned, such as restless leg syndrome or periodic limb movements where someone has the urge to move their leg. And so you can definitely wake up. That can also affect your partner's sleep if you co-sleep with someone else. And then, as you mentioned, narcolepsy, which is a condition in which someone initiates sleep really quickly and unexpectedly and can happen periodically throughout a day, which for the obvious reasons can be very dangerous.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that could be scary, too, if they're driving or, you know, all of a sudden they get sleepy.
Absolutely.
And, you know, speaking of insomnia, is that being one of the, you know, the most common sleep disorder, what would you say is like the key difference between someone maybe not needing a lot of sleep and then really having that insomnia? Is it the frequency or what is it? Because I think so many people are really, I mean, let's be honest, a lot of people are just fueled by caffeine half the time. So how do they know it's just like a real problem?
Yes. So short sleep duration is a problem, as well as long sleep duration. So for adults, if you sleep less than 7 hours on average, which is the recommended amount, it's associated with those same adverse health consequences that I mentioned in relation to insomnia and sleep apnea. And so that's just sleeping, you know, less than a certain amount. We have cutoffs across different age groups. That's the definition of short sleep. Now, when we're talking about insomnia, we're not just talking about sleeping a short period. We're talking about a problem with falling asleep. So your initiation of sleep takes longer than the average person without insomnia. And in addition to having a delayed sleep onset, you also find more wakefulness during the night. So individuals with insomnia, they'll wake for long periods during the night. And so taken together, yes, you can end up with a short sleep duration, but you'll also find that people tend to be in bed a lot longer because they're trying to sleep. But that's where the problem is with insomniac. They actually have a problem with initiating sleep and staying asleep. And this can occur for any of us, especially for people with high stressful jobs or students. We will go through spells of having a problem with sleeping, or even if there's a lot on your mind, right? Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean you have insomnia. We're talking about whether or not this happens repeatedly, you know, more than 3 times a week. That's when it becomes a problem, not just you know, I have a big test tomorrow, or I have this big project or something happening your next day. So having the chronic experiences of those symptoms is what makes the disorder insomnia.
You know, thank you, Dr. Dana. It's so, and I'm so glad that you clarified the difference between the two and really thinking about whether, you know, the sleep is being initiated and how long it takes to actually fall asleep and stay asleep. And then you also mentioned there's also an issue if you sleep too much, because, you know, we all know friends who can go to sleep with the drop of a hat and they literally just sleep all day. I mean, so where do you see the adverse health issues there?
Sure. So sleeping for adults, sleeping longer than 9 hours is considered bad for your health. And so it's important for me to also note that the data are a little bit mixed, and I'll explain why that may be. So oftentimes when we see someone that's sleeping longer than 9 hours, it can be associated with depression. So people that are depressed tend to be in bed and sleep a lot longer. And so that is not a good thing for our health, right? Now, the reason why it's a little controversial when we talk about long sleep, the reason why we can't just say it's totally bad, is if you have a period of sleep deprivation, so meaning if there's a period of the time where you're not sleeping a lot, let's say you are, you have a project or you're working on something that's very stressful. And so for several days, you sleep, let's say 5 to 6 hours. So when you finish, your body needs sleep, right? So you're going to have a long period of sleep following that, which is essentially trying to restore and deplete that sleep load that you have built. Now, there's no such thing as catching up on your sleep. Once it's gone, it's gone. But we do have what can be considered a recovery sleep. So after a period of not sleeping a lot, you will have a long sleep period. And that doesn't mean that there's something bad that's happening. But let's say you are sleeping a long period of time that is not associated with having a shorter period prior to that, then that's where we see that there's a problem associated with depression, so adverse mental health outcomes, as well as some physical health outcomes. We see that long sleepers also tend to be obese and also have a higher risk of hypertension and other cardiovascular outcomes, adverse cardiovascular outcomes.
That is so fascinating to me, because I think just how a lot of people don't realize how dental hygiene can be related to cardiovascular heart health. People don't realize how the sleep is. And so I know you've done several studies on cardiovascular health. And how does the poor sleep quality contribute to heart disease?
Yes, so great question. So there's many pathways by which we see where sleep is connected to cardiovascular outcomes. The most simple path that some of us can think about is stress, for example. And so it can be stressful and overwhelming, especially those with insomnia that can cause anxiety. And we know that that can impact sleep and has a bidirectional relationship in a way and can lead to cardiovascular outcomes. Now, in terms of physiologic pathways, a lot of what I study in my work, so there are different hormones that are secreted during our sleep period. Also, when we sleep, this is the time that we have healing and repairing to our blood vessels. So if you are not sleeping an adequate amount, you don't have that same healing and repairing that can occur to your blood vessels, and that's directly connected to cardiovascular health. Also, when we sleep, there is a dipping of our blood pressure, and so that is needed. So when you go to sleep, you have this dipping, but think about if you are constantly waking up, regardless to what the reason may be. For some, it may be nocturia, people are going to the bathroom a lot, or it could be other conditions such as sleep apnea, if you're, you know, moving a lot during your sleep process and you have a lack of dipping. That can contribute to a higher blood pressure. If you have a higher blood pressure at night, that can translate to a higher blood pressure during the day, which is hypertension, which is directly connected to cardiovascular disease. And then there's other pathways that include metabolism, for example. There's disrupted sleep can lead to a decrease in brain glucose utilization, which can lead to an altered glucose metabolism, and that can operate through diabetes or insulin resistance, which leads to diabetes and hypertension. And then there's also a pathway through weight gain. And there's different ways you can think about this. You know, one simple way is when you're awake. So if you're sleeping a shorter amount, that means you're awake longer, right? And so if you're awake longer, you have more of an opportunity to intake calories. Mm-hmm. And so if you're awake longer, you're trying to fuel yourself, you eat more, you have more calories that can result in obesity, which we know is directly related to cardiovascular disease. And then the other piece of that I talked about when I first began, I talked about the hormone secretion. So we have specific hormones, leptin and ghrelin, that are connected to our ability to feel hungry, and then also our ability to feel full. And so when we don't have a sufficient amount of sleep, or when our sleep is disturbed, those hormones become imbalanced. And so we have a harder time deciding when we're actually full. And then we can feel hungry when we're not actually hungry.
So true.
And then the last piece I'll say is that there's an effect on our decision-making process when we don't have enough sleep. I'm sure we can all think about a time that we were sleep deprived and you were a little irritable, or you couldn't think exactly, you know, as clear as you typically would think about something. And so there's evidence that shows when people are sleep deprived, they're more likely to get a donut instead of perhaps something that's more protein fueling, like a chicken breast and salad or something. People are more likely to choose food that are high in sugar, and then that's related to obesity, and then also diabetes, and so on. It can lead to cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, I really appreciate you going into detail about that, and it makes sense, because if you're sleep deprived, you're reaching for like something sugary, like candy, or you know, people get that 3 p.m. Mm-hmm. slump or whatever. But that's because your blood sugar is low, because you need the energy to continue on your day. But then it becomes like this awful cycle, right?
Right, exactly.
I'm chuckling, but it's really not funny, because it's just like, wow, you think about something as natural as sleep, but there's really so much more to it in order to really lead a healthy life. And I'm gonna sort of like public health nerd out for a minute. I think most of my listeners know, you know, I have a background in public health, and so I really would love to really start talking about some of the key social and environmental determinants mm-hmm. of health that can relate to sleep health disparities or people having some disordered sleep. And can you share a little bit about what social determinants of health are, mm-hmm. some examples for folks, as well as environmental determinants of health?
Sure. So when we talk about social determinants of health, we're talking about non-medical factors. So social, behavioral, environmental, that can affect health outcomes. And some examples of social determinants of health include socioeconomic status. So someone's education level, occupation, or income level. Those are great examples. Additionally, other social factors may include discrimination, something that we know that historically minoritized individuals often face. And so there's an array of different social factors that that people experience. And so in terms of environmental factors, and I'll talk about how these are connected, we're talking about factors in the environment that can negatively affect health outcomes. And so that could be air pollution. In the diet or nutrition realm, they talk about food deserts. So places that lack fresh fruits and vegetables. Also in relation to sleep, since that's the topic we're talking about, more noise, inopportune light exposure. Those are the environmental hazards that are negatively affecting sleep. And the way that all of these are connected really are rooted in structural racism. And so structural racism being the root cause of health inequities. And so these are factors, or, you know, a really good example of it is thinking about residential segregation. So there were historical racist laws such as redlining that determined whether neighborhoods were worthy of investment or not. And Black and Brown individuals were more likely to live in those neighborhoods that were deemed unworthy. And this has historical generational effects to even present day, where we still see that neighborhoods have remain disadvantaged and have not reaped the same benefits. So basically what happens is in these neighborhoods, there is, so for example, the education system. So there's less funds that are put into the educational system. And so we know that that's directly related to our upward trajectory. So individuals that live in disadvantaged neighborhoods tend to have worse quality education and lower, which sometimes translates to lower graduation rates, over policing, other negative effects that really disenfranchise certain populations, again, namely Black and Brown populations. Mm-hmm. And so then you have a lower income, right? Because perhaps those individuals aren't going to college or having the same educational advancement. And so when you have a lower income, then that determines where you live, right? And so then it becomes this cycle that you're constantly living in the disadvantaged neighborhoods and having children who tend to be subjected to the same effects. And so these neighborhoods, in addition to these limited educational opportunities, also have limited resources, tend not to have great access to healthcare. Transportation can be an issue, and other factors that can relate to the ability to access care or potentially gain upward mobility. So those are all the social determinants, or really examples of social determinants. And what we're studying is how those factors, so whether or not someone's experiences with discrimination or racism, living in disadvantaged neighborhoods, how that contributes, in my case, to adverse sleep health and in the field overall to health outcomes.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, a lot of people don't consider how where they live, work, play, whether it's, you know, like you said, having the finances for healthy food or access to healthcare, even community support, you know, those all play a role.
Absolutely.
And in our sleep health. And I don't know if you can even speak to, because here, you know, Joyfully Black, we're always about what are the things you need to do in order to keep yourself in the black? Because that's just not a financial term, but it's
right.
Is it perspective? Is it making sure your finances are in order? Is it making sure you get enough rest? Mm-hmm. Is it, you know, getting your exercise or what have you? So, I mean, in any of the studies that you've done, have you seen how community support plays mm-hmm. a role in sleep health?
Absolutely. And so we use the term social cohesion. And mm-hmm. so social cohesion really relates to how well someone, in this case, knows their neighbors, whether or not they trust their neighbors. And this tends to be a salient factor for Black individuals in particular. Having people around that you trust and can depend on, having strong social networks, we're seeing as a positive attribute and potentially protective of poor sleep health. So people who live, Black individuals in particular, which we found in our studies, that live in neighborhoods with higher social cohesion, also areas where they feel safe, they have better sleep health outcomes. And, you know, just to give a slight example, we're talking about neighborhood level factors. But in some of the work we've done where we've looked within people's homes, if people talk about, so we'll probably get into this, there is a term called sleep hygiene, which really is about healthy sleep habits. And some of those habits that my colleagues and I stress are sometimes habits that, or things that people that live in certain neighborhoods do not have the privilege to be able to partake in. For example, sleeping in a dark, quiet room. If you live somewhere that has a lot of crime or violence, that can be potentially dangerous. And so in some of my studies, participants have shared that it's not safe because someone could potentially break into their homes. So because of that, we find when individuals live in these safe environments, they're able to implement these healthy practices, such as sleeping in a dark, quiet room. And that's promoting, you know, to one, keeping anxiety levels down, and also helping to have a healthy sleep regimen.
Oh, no, that's great. I'm really glad you spoke to that. And speaking of sleep hygiene, what are some steps that individuals can take to sort of mitigate or even minimize the effects of these social and environmental determinants on their sleep?
Yes, it's a really, really good question, because some of these factors that are highly contributing to poor sleep among racially minoritized groups can be tough to deal with, right? So things like racism, microaggressions, discrimination, those are not individual level factors, right? That's not something you can control typically when someone is discriminating against you. Mm-hmm. So what we do in my work is study how we can intervene at a higher level. So meaning in the workplace environment, at the neighborhood level, how we can adjust laws and so on in order to facilitate better environments for individuals to have healthy sleep practices. So those are larger things, right? Now, at the individual level, I also have studies where we talk about engaging in activities that help to relax the mind and brain before sleep. And so I have a study where we did mindfulness, and we had people engage in 10 minutes of mindfulness activities, breathing and so on, to really set the mood for sleep and relax them. And so we have data that shows that, you know, that had a positive impact on their sleep. People were able to initiate sleep faster and also stay asleep longer periods of time. In addition to that, some of it is just about having the right bedtime routine. And so I often say, you know, try and avoid triggering things before bed. And so in general, part of the sleep hygiene recommendations include removing electronics from your bedroom, not having a television, not scrolling on social media, as hard as that may be, before mm-hmm. bed, because you don't know what you may see. So there's one, there could be triggering video, but also the light exposure. And so you want to make sure before you go to sleep that you decrease your light exposure. So when we receive light in, that's telling us to be awake. And so when it's dark, that's telling us it's sleep. So you want to start to set that stage. So having a routine that you consistently implement can really help to have healthy sleep practices. In addition to some of those other factors that I mentioned, such as sleeping in a quiet, dark room, again, remove electronics. Those are just some of the tips. Additionally, having a comfortable mattress.
Okay. So,
that's really important to sleep somewhere that feels good for you. And additionally, I'll say the temperature in the room should be what's comfortable for you and for everybody. That can be different, especially for men, for women who are going through menopause and experiencing hot flashes. That can be really hard. But we do know that temperature can affect sleep practices and sleep overall.
Oh, I really appreciate you sharing those practical tips for better sleep. So I'm hearing you say, you know, going to sleep in a darkened room if you can, mm-hmm. minimizing the amount of light exposure from a television screen or from your cell phone. Because I know a lot of people do scroll. I mean, myself included,
Scroll
before going to bed. What are your thoughts on, I saw a commercial recently, I can't remember who was advertising it, but on different like brown noise versus pink noise versus night noise. What's your take on those things?
Yeah, so really good question. And I think, so in general, it's best to be in a quiet room in general. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, there's we're actually doing a study now where we're just looking at noise level. Now, there is some work that says that certain noises can be okay. For example, listening to, you know, the ocean can be very soothing for some people. And this is where the key falls in. I tend not to subscribe to these, you know, this is something for everybody, right?
Sure.
So I think some of these are on an individual basis. If that's something you find soothing, then it's not a problem, right? Engage in it. Now, the problem comes, sometimes we get used to certain noises. So for example, for somebody who lives near a train station, they may not hear that train go by. And as soon as someone comes and stays with them, they're like, oh my gosh, you know, I woke up 10 times because your train went by, right? And then you're like, oh, I don't even hear it. But that doesn't mean your brain doesn't hear it, right? So when people say, you know, I can sleep and that didn't disturb me, when we do studies, we actually see that they wake up. And it's just a matter of being conscious when you wake up, right? So there are periods where you can be disturbed and it negatively affects your sleep, and you may not be aware of that. So again, I subscribe to the idea of no noise. But, you know, there's some evidence that supports that some noises are safe. And it's, you know, you may need to decide for yourself what's comforting and do I feel good with that? And often I say the next day is how you can determine whether or not your sleep went well or not. How did you feel? That satisfaction is important.
Yeah, no, that's really key. You're customizing it, but I mean, the gold standard is no noise. But of course, mm-hmm. like you said, you can assess the next morning to see how you feel. And it's interesting that you say that, because something that has helped me go to sleep, because I'm a person, my brain just is always going. And I notice that if I put on the audiobook, but I put the sleep timer on, because it's like, I'm probably going to be asleep within 15 to 30 minutes. I put the sleep timer on and, you know, I'm listening. And at some point I fall asleep, but the phone is off. I'm listening versus watching a screen. And it's like my brain that needs a lot of activity is satisfied, but then finally it's able to settle down without me forcing it to settle down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And, you know, there are a few things that you're doing with that, right? So one is you're just distracting your brain. So I heard you say you're a thinker. And so that happens, right? You're thinking about all these things. And that actually happens a lot for people with insomnia, right? And so often what we say is like, just get up and write those things down so it's not on your mind anymore, right? But you're giving your mind a distraction. You're closing your eyes maybe. So you're starting to set that mood for sleep. So those are all good things.
Oh, good. That's great to hear from the expert.
Yeah. And that feels good for you. And I love the fact that you said a timer. And so often when I meet with people, and when we're talking to participants and they're like, I have to sleep with the television on. And, you know, of course, I'm telling them not to. But we compromise on set a timer. Mm-hmm. Let it go off so it doesn't wake you up in the middle of the night. When you fall asleep, it just goes off. So having those, you know, little tips like setting these alarms are a really good thing.
Oh, great. And so you really like, I love these tips that you've offered up today. But, and I also think about, as people are trying to make these, you know, healthy lifestyle changes in their life, in the back of our minds is also like cultural practices, right? Or like you hear somebody in the back of your mind, whether it's your grandma, your dad, whoever, about sleep. And so have you come across any cultural practices or beliefs that either positively or negatively impact sleep health in communities of color, whether it's Black, Latino, or otherwise?
Yes. And here, they tend to be mostly negative. Excuse me. So one is, so I talked about sleep apnea. And a symptom of sleep apnea is snoring. And I have heard from several individuals that that meant that they got a great night of sleep. Like, I slept well because I was snoring. Excuse me. And I'm often like, that's not true. You know, you did not get a great night of sleep because you were snoring. Typically, you probably got a worse night, but that's just a misconception. And it's actually a symptom of a sleep disorder and not a symptom that you got great sleep. And so there tends to be certain communities that I hear that most often in. And then in some communities, like the Latin community, there's the siesta, right? Which is this idea of taking in a long nap midday. Now, this can be good or bad, right? And so typically we suggest that people do not sleep longer than 20 minutes at a nap time. And the reason is because if you sleep too long, you run the risk of disrupting your sleep that night. So if you sleep for 2-3 hours, especially if it's later in the afternoon, you're not going to be tired at 9, 10 o'clock when it's time for your bedtime. So it's going to be delayed. So you're going to sleep longer. And then if you have a traditional job, you still have to wake up at the same time. And now you're in this cycle of, oh my gosh, now I need a nap because I'm really tired. Now, the good thing is if you are tired, you should absolutely take a nap, but you have to control the amount of time. So those are just two examples of cultural is sometimes cultural norms and cultural misconceptions around sleep. And I've heard others from the Caribbean population, which talks about spirits coming in for if someone goes into if they for narcolepsy, excuse me, for example. And you know, in my work, it's not about whether or not we say that this is right or wrong, right? Like, because some of these cultural things we just may not understand, right? But it's about making sure people understand what symptoms are related to sleep disorders and knowing that there are potential treatments. And so we're not necessarily trying to, unless it's really dangerous, you know, my idea is not to debunk, you know, these cultural factors, because some of them can be good things, right? But more so for us to understand them and then also understand how modern day or Western medicine can come in to, you know, help individuals with sleep disorders.
Okay. Yeah, I'm really glad that you mentioned some of those nuances or things or misconceptions that we, you know, might hear growing up, depending on our communities. And of course, the focus of this podcast is all about, you know, self-care and staying mentally well. And so what can you kind of discuss, like, the relationship? And you touched on this a bit with when people sleep too much, sometimes that's a sign of depression, but sort of that relationship between sleep and mental health in general?
Yeah. So sleep and mental health are closely tied. In fact, sleep tends to be a symptom or an item in many scales that are assessing different mental health conditions, such as depression. You know, having restless sleep is part of the diagnostic criterion for depression. And so I talked about anxiety and sleep being closely related. We found that that was very connected during the pandemic, when people were very anxious about either getting COVID or having a loved one who may have been diagnosed, and they were concerned about whether or not they may die. You know, in addition to lost wages and other factors that were a result of the pandemic, we saw a lot of anxiety, and that translated to a lot of restless sleep. And so, you know, so those are just two examples. And then also we talked about mood. So getting a sufficient amount of sleep is really important for your mood. I'm telling you, and I'm sure you can think about this. We talked about this earlier, right? I know that for me, if I have, you know, a shorter night of sleep, I'm a little moody the next day. Yeah. You know, I might be a little short. And you're like, okay, I'm tired. And so we, you know, there was a funny meme going around social media where these two kids are eating at the table, and one of the kids is, you know, acting up and acting out. And the brother says, "You need a nap." And, you know, that's true, right? Like, we know that, and we see that in kids, but it's the same thing for adults, right? But sometimes when we're really tired, we tend to act out.
Yes.
And, you know, some of us have a better way of controlling that than others. And, you know, on the more serious side, especially when it comes to children, you know, often we're seeing that children are getting misdiagnosed as having a behavioral problem when it's actually a sleep problem, which can be treated easily, right?
No,
easily within realm, you know, but
sure,
it can be treated, but it's being misdiagnosed as a behavioral problem because they're probably irritable and, you know, they're acting out in class, but often we see that they have undiagnosed sleep apnea and they're not getting enough sleep. And again, children have a harder time controlling their emotions than adults.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is fascinating. I mean, yeah, because it seems like there are more and more children being diagnosed with behavioral issues than before. And I'm always curious about that. So, you know, you mentioned that connection between the quality of sleep they're getting. And I wasn't even aware that children get sleep apnea, because you really only hear of adults, older people, frankly, you know?
Yes, children definitely get sleep apnea. It's closely related to asthma. And then often we see that it can, by having their tonsils removed. So sometimes that obstruction in the airways, their tonsils are enlarged. So having the tonsils removed can often resolve it. And so I think it's just talked about less, but absolutely. And again, within this realm of sleep inequities, we see that children who live in disadvantaged neighborhoods have the highest risk of sleep apnea, maybe related to air pollution, which can cause inflammation of the airway. But yes, children definitely can get sleep apnea, can have sleep apnea, and it's common.
Wow. And that really is a great segue into, you know, advice for women of color who are Black women, women of color, who they may be listening today and say, oh, I have some of these symptoms. How did it go about seeking medical help for sleep disorders for themselves or maybe someone in their family? Mm-hmm. Some of these signs are sounding familiar.
Yes, great, great, great question. So the first thing is to be aware of these different symptoms that I've talked about, right? And so if someone finds that they are tired the next day, if someone tells you you're snoring, if you're having a hard time sleeping consistently within your sleep period, so if you're going to bed and you're waking up several times per night, that is not normal and is likely a symptom of a sleep problem. And so the first thing to do is to have a conversation with your primary care doctor. And so what we're seeing is that oftentimes when people go in for a primary care appointment, which may be what, 15 minutes, they're not being asked about their sleep. So you're asked about other factors and they treat those, but you're often not asked about your sleep. And so we're encouraging people to, you know, in addition to working with primary care physicians, but encouraging individuals when they go in to see their primary care doctor, start that conversation by saying, I'm experiencing these specific symptoms. Can I have a referral to a sleep clinic? And so if you get a referral, you can go. And some insurance companies will allow you to go without the referral. So this is just dependent on the way your insurance is set up. But you want to get to a sleep clinic and you want to talk to a sleep specialist. And depending on what your symptoms are, they can recommend a certain screening, whether it's an overnight sleep apnea test, which can actually be done in your home. So traditionally, you would have to go to a lab, stay overnight. But we have modern technology now where you can be mailed a device and it can measure your severity of sleep apnea while you're at home in a comfortable setting. You know, in other instances, if you have symptoms of insomnia, they can give you a validated questionnaire, which can assess your severity there. So you want to have a conversation with your either primary care doctor and or sleep physician or sleep specialist in order to get the right screening to see what your sleep problem may be and then diagnosis. Now, I'll also say, and I have this conversation with many of my friends, and they call me and they're like, I have a sleep problem, but I can't sleep, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you do not. You work too hard. And you are just, you're stressed out. And so, you know, it's also important to understand the difference there, right? If you are working to, if you have a traditional job and you're working to 8, 9 o'clock and, you know, you're high stress, you know, it's going to take you a while to calm down before you can go to sleep and so on. And so in that case, it's not the sleep problem. It's not a sleep problem. It's a stress problem, which is a determinant, right? Which can contribute to sleep problems, but you want to address the stressor there. So it's, you know, it's also having a understanding of what's happening and having those proper conversations. But if all else, you know, it's important to just introduce that conversation with your primary care doctor and potentially a sleep specialist to see if what you're experiencing is a sleep problem.
Oh, that's so helpful to know, because I think so many folks don't realize what the steps are in order to really get the help that they need. And just like when your girlfriend, you know, asks your, may say, oh, I'm having a sleep issue, but it's really stress. You know, knowing that there's, they have a you, right? But everyone doesn't have a Dr. Dana they can pick up the phone and just call. So that is so important to notice. And you mentioned something about, you know, the relation of stress. And so would you say that when people start to, I guess, become aware that maybe it's maybe my high stressful job or maybe a family situation, removing that stressor, is that how they can tell whether it is truly a sleep issue or whether it's a stress issue?
Right. So I'm so glad you brought that up. So it is a process to figure that out. For some people, they can acknowledge, oh, yes, you know, when it's the end of the quarter, you know, and I have all of these things to submit, I find that I'm not sleeping well during those times because there's a lot on my mind, right? And then for others, it's just a matter of not knowing because you don't have those off periods where you do have a reference to, oh, I sleep well at these times. And those are the ones that I'm really most concerned about. But regardless, even if it's a stress issue, you have to figure out how to manage that. And we have professionals to help with that. Seeing a therapist is really important to be able to disentangle what's actually happening. If it's the stress, if it's a sleep problem, in some cases, therapists are trained to be able to talk about that. One of the most effective treatments for insomnia is cognitive behavioral therapy. And so, you know, having that conversation, you know, with a therapist to understand, you know, what you're experiencing and the next steps are really important. And so, especially some of us often try and self-diagnose. So I'm suggesting not to do that, right? Like, so try, you know, in for those of us that, you know, do have insurance, utilize that. Now, I can understand for those that may be uninsured, it can be hard to figure out your resources. And so there are community resources, there are community clinics, and it's important to reach out. So even if there's not a community clinic, going to a major hospital where you can find out about services for uninsured patients and still, you know, receive the treatment and screening that you need.
Now, something else that you mentioned, you know, we do have, I'm not there yet, but we do have, you know, women in the perimenopausal, like getting to be a women of a certain age. So, you know, how does sleep health change as women age and what should they be aware of? And I think something that's really come to mind for me is also we hear about how, oh, as you get older, you need less sleep. is that true? What should women be thinking of as they get out of their dirty 30s and going on to those flirty 40s and beyond?
Right. So that's not true. It's not the fact that you need less sleep. As we age, we tend to sleep less. Those are two different things, right? And so some of the reasons why we end up sleeping less, for some people that are post 60, it tends to be side effects from medications. We start seeing more health problems start to occur. You may be on some medications, and that can affect your sleep. And for women that are going through menopause, it's hot flashes. And so one of the main symptoms that women talk about that are going through menopause is that their sleep is disrupted. And we know that sometimes it's because of the hot flashes, and it's because of other hormonal changes. I talked about how important sleep is for balancing our hormones. And so when we're going through menopause, this part where our hormones are definitely out of balance is going to have that same effect to where our sleep is disrupted. And so that's why we start seeing people are sleeping less, but your need for sleep does not change. And, you know, I wish I had a great solution or treatment or positive thing that I can say about it, but you know, the truth of it is that this is a very popular area of research right now. We're trying to understand sleep among menopausal women. And unfortunately, right now, we're just not at a place where we know research-wise what exactly to do. There are, you know, hormones and other things that you can take to help balance. But we do know that sleep gets disrupted during this time. And again, it's important to work with your physician to have the best outcome in relation to your sleep. But it is a symptom of that menopause state is having disrupted sleep, and we don't know why.
That's so fascinating. And are there any, you know, promising areas of research and sleep health that you're really excited about, in addition to, of course, what's going on with menopausal women? What are the areas that are really just kind of jazzing you up right now?
Yeah. So in the work that I'm doing, we're really, really focused on addressing and eliminating sleep inequities. And so what we're doing in a few studies that I have is understanding people's home environment and understanding what about the environment that we can change to help people sleep better, whether it's weatherizing homes. So for people who live in older homes, you know, there is a potential benefit to having it weatherized that can help with mitigating some of those adverse temperatures. And other factors that can potentially, you know, adversely affect sleep. And so we're talking about physical things, but there's also this financial piece, right? So having older homes that are not weatherized can cause you to have pay a higher gas bill in the winter. And so that can lead to financial stress, which we talked about how that can affect your sleep. And so we're trying to study and understand, you know, what we can intervene on in the home environment. You know, the other thing that is really exciting me, we have a project where we're focused on mindfulness. I think I mentioned this earlier, and we're utilizing artificial intelligence and other wearables where we can push these reminders and different exercises to individuals and help to really relax the mind and help with the coping that many of us experience. And so, you know, there was that big wave when Beyonce's song came out, like, quit your job. And you don't understand for that. Some of us can't quit our jobs, right? Like, some of us are in these stressful environments and still need the money. And so what we're doing in my group is trying to, you know, figure out and determine the best coping strategies to help us, you know, not carry that home, not carry that to bed. So what can help us live our best lives while also having these, you know, high demanding occupations? And so we're focused on individuals that are professionals who actually have worse sleep than lower income individuals, which is really interesting, specifically within the Black community. And so we're doing studies now where we're identifying those coping strategies that are necessary to deal with these stressful environments while also trying to change these environments. So we're doing it from both angles. And so it's really exciting to study that and, you know, really, really make a difference and try and improve sleep. So the idea is that if we intervene and improve sleep, we can prevent subsequent adverse health consequences like cardiovascular disease, like early mortality, and so on that are disproportionately affecting Black and Brown individuals.
Oh, wow. Those are fascinating. And if there were someone that wanted to get involved with, you know, for, I guess when you're saying like folks who are professionals who you're seeing are having worse sleep quality than even people in lower income communities, how would they get involved with those sort of studies?
Yeah, so good question. So depending on, so my study is in Atlanta, and so we're recruiting, so we have a pretty lengthy eligibility survey that people go through, excuse me. But for people who live in other areas, there's oftentimes lists of studies that are, you can find at hospitals. Yeah. So if you're interested in joining a research study, you can often look on hospital websites where they advertise for clinical research studies. Also at universities, you look for postings. I often see them at grocery stores, sometimes at the gym. You can Google and really try and identify some research studies that are occurring that you can participate in, where you can contribute, you know, information, but also, you know, you don't need a research study in order to benefit, right? You can, again, going back to talking to your primary care doctor, if you're interested, but I understand that. And I love the fact that people want to participate in research studies. So I would just keep an eye out or actively look in Google. For my studies, we sometimes target individuals so we can, we recruit in clinics. And then others, we post ads on social media, which we often send through advertisements. And so you may see that I often, and it could be because I'm an epidemiologist, when I'm online, I often get ads for research studies. So I would just say keep an eye out, but you can actively look by checking hospital websites and also local university.
Oh, wonderful. And are there any specific books or podcasts or other resources that you would recommend to someone who's really wanting to improve their sleep hygiene?
Yes, I was a part of this really cool documentary called The Quest for Sleep. It is on YouTube and it's not long. It's a little over an hour and it takes you through a few people's experiences with insomnia. And myself and two other sleep professionals are featured where we talk about different tips. We sometimes make reference to some of the individuals that are featured in the campaign or in the documentary, rather. So I highly, highly recommend watching that. It is extremely knowledgeable or is extremely effective at teaching different aspects of sleep. And it is narrated by Octavia Spencer, which is great. And has some professional athletes that are in the documentary, in addition to people that we identify with. So there's a nurse, there's a hairstylist. So there's different people. So there's someone for everybody that they could potentially identify with. So that's one great resource. Additionally, Again, looking up sleep clinics in your area is really important, and you can directly reach out to get information about their resources from Promoting Sleep. Additionally, other books that I would recommend, you know, a lot of the books I read are very textbook driven. Mm-hmm. So I can't think of any off the top of my head. But I will share after and can definitely put in the comments about other social books that may be helpful. And then additionally, I would say, you know, look for different campaigns on social media. There's some really, really cool groups. One is the Nat Ministry, who is doing really, really great things about promoting rest and sleep in the Black community. So I would highly recommend looking up some of the events that are led by the NAP ministry. And then Google tends to be our best friend, which should also be our best enemy, right? Like, you want to make sure that the information that you're getting comes from reliable sources. But I often contribute to articles that are published, whether it's in Science or the New York Times. So you can look up information about sleep. There's some on websites like the Harvard Sleep Group. There's articles there. So I would say that just really look online and reach out to your local sleep clinic to get information, and then watch that documentary. It's really good.
Oh, absolutely. So I will share those resources in the show notes. And yeah, the NAP Ministry, I mean, yes, I love the work that she's doing, and it's just been so amazing to see the growth of that initiative. Yeah. And I know you've shared a lot of tips what people can do, but I'm curious, could you share like your own sleep routine or tips that you find effective?
Yes. So I have an entire routine that's very relaxing for me. That's, you know, it takes about an hour. But this is just my slow move into that. So probably about an hour to sometimes a little bit more before I go to sleep, I dim the lights. And so I start to set that stage. So I dim the lights. I'm very much about skincare and hygiene. And so once, you know, I start the dimming of lights, you know, either it's sometimes, it may not always be a shower, sometimes it's a shower, or it's always like, let me do my skincare routine, which is relaxing for me. You know, my husband and I may have some, you know, conversation that we may have that are very, nothing too stressful, calming conversation. I may read a little something, I get in the bed, and then I go to sleep. You know, I don't get in bed and watch television or, you know, do anything that is brain stimulating. So the whole idea is for me to do kind of mindless things. Now, there are times that I may have a lot on my mind. And so I also put my phone on night mode. And so I have a dark, I turn my light all the way down on my phone. I do keep it near me because I use it. I actually don't set an alarm, but I do still have my phone near me, but I totally dim it and put it on the night setting. But all of these things, so if there is a lot on my mind, I take my phone and I go to my notes page and I write it down. So let's say I know I have a really busy day. You know, the next day is going to be really busy for me. So instead of me constantly thinking about and going over my to-do list and spending time stimulating my brain, which keeps me awake, I just grab my phone and I write it down. And so I don't try and remember. So that active process of trying to remember, okay, I have to do this at 8 o'clock and do this at 9 o'clock, they're stimulating. So I try and remove all of that. So I write it down. And then I go to sleep. And so, you know, it sounds simple, but, you know, I take that whole, you know, hour and I just do what's nourishing to me in that moment. You know, I am not having any intense conversations. I often will not answer if, you know, if somebody calls because I don't want to get into, you know, these tense things. It's all about creating a relaxing environment for me.
Oh, I love that. And, you know, that's self-care. If you know it's that relative that they can get on your last nerve, you're like, nope.
Right. Sorry. I'm not answering.
No, no. And I love that you're saying you and your husband will have a nice, relaxing conversation. Nothing that's going to get your blood pressure up before you're trying
nothing.
To you know, get into your mindset and ready for rest. And do you
right. And yeah.
Mm-hmm, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and we don't talk about work at that point.
Oh, good.
So there's no work conversation that is to be done during the day. At a certain point, we cut off those conversations.
Oh, that's good. And do you find that, like, since really delving into the world of sleep health disparities, it's impacted what your routine is? Like, have you seen a shift in your routine since getting into this work?
Absolutely. So when I first started doing sleep work over 14 years ago, I told you I didn't think about my sleep at all. It was just a thing I did. And so when I started reading about it, I was like, oh my God, I got to go to sleep. Like, it became this like important piece, you know, that I need to make sure I get a certain amount of sleep. And then when I got to a certain point in my career, which was really amazing, and it's absolutely a privilege, I could set my own schedule. So I mentioned I don't set an alarm, which again, I totally understand the privilege I have in that. But when I got to a certain point, I was like, I'm not setting morning meetings. So just like I have a bedtime routine, I have an entire morning routine. I don't like to be rushed. I don't like, you know, I don't want to be late. So I make sure that I don't schedule morning things. I like to exercise. I have tea in the morning. You know, I have this entire routine that's really important to me. And so I set my schedule that it lends itself to what feels good to me.
I love that. And it actually makes me want to go down a whole nother rabbit hole of people who are night owls who try to make themselves be morning larks and vice versa. And but you know what? That means I got to have you back then so we can have that.
I would love to come back. This has been amazing. And yes, this is an entire field, right? Like, there's so much to talk about. You know, I mentioned things about light, but yes, there's circadian rhythms that are entrained by the light dark cycle. And whether or not we work, you know, against our natural chronotypes, or it's a whole ordeal.
It
and
is.
I am happy to come back and talk about it another day.
Love it. Well, there is a question I ask every single guest, because one of my favorite quotes is by Jean Boleyn. It says, when you discover something that nourishes your soul and brings you joy, care enough about yourself to make room for it in your life. So this does not have to be sleep related.
I love that. I love that.
But, you know, Dr. Dana, what nourishes your soul so much that you absolutely create space for it?
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh. That's a good question. So I would say doing whatever I want for a certain part of my day. And I mean that. So, and it looks different. It's not necessarily something where, you know, like every day I do this one thing that, you know, makes me so joyful. But the fact that I carve out a certain amount of time that's just for me, where I am doing things that are only for me, not my family, not my staff, not my students, right? That's what's joyful to me, right? Like creating space every day in my day to do what I want. And sometimes that's literally, for the popular media folks, that's literally me on the Shade Room laughing. And I am totally fine with that. I will spend 10 minutes, you know, looking at a video, looking at different videos, and that feels good to me. So I do it. And so that's what I create space for every day, no matter what. I'm going to do what I want. And some days that might be, I'm going to go spin. I'm going to take a walk, whatever it is. I make sure that I reserve at least an hour for me. And, you know, again, it may vary, but it's essentially I carve out a time where there is nothing happening for anybody else but me.
Oh, I love that. I love that. And that's part of, you know, your self-care journey too, you know, carving out that space. So a final thought for our listeners. What is you've dropped so many gems today. What is one key message or just piece of advice that you would like to leave with our Joyfully Black listeners about maintaining or starting good sleep health practices or maintaining good sleep health?
Yeah. So I would, I think what's really important, I talked about a lot of tips, you know, the dark room, right? No electronic. I didn't mention this, but, you know, making sure that if you have caffeine, that you have it earlier in the day. If you take a nap, that is earlier in the day. There's lots of tips, but I think what's important is not trying to do everything, right? And I think oftentimes that's what makes behavioral change so hard for people, right? So it's a new year. Everyone's like, I'm going to go exercise every day. I'm only going to eat, you know, 1500 calories, whatever, whatever. You know, when that happens, you know, we fall off because it's too much. So I would encourage people in thinking about these different tips. What is something that you can do? Maybe one change that can make a difference in your sleep. I'm not saying you need to do everything on the list, but think about what you can do for you. And you mentioned self-care, so I'm just going to add that in. I would say create a bedtime routine that feels good for you. And so integrate that into your self-care. Create that space to make for a easy environment for you to sleep in. So that would be my main tip. Don't try and take on too much. Just try one thing and just create a routine for yourself.
Absolutely. Keeping it simple and try one thing at a time.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Dana. It has been such a pleasure chatting with you today.
You are very welcome. And thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Wow. It was great having Dr. Dana join us to share insight on sleep health disparities and all the myriad of ways that they touch our lives and communities. And now I'd really love to hear what stood out to you in today's episode. How is sleep affecting your health in daily life? What strategies did you hear that you found effective in overcoming maybe sleep challenges you or a family member or loved one has? Are there any cultural practices or beliefs about sleep that you found particularly interesting or impactful today? I would love to hear your questions and experiences because Dr. Dana was not playing. She will be back in the future, y'all. And your stories and questions not only enrich our conversation, but really just help us all learn and grow together. So connect with us on social media at Joyfully Black or shoot us an email. I'd really love to keep the conversation going. So you know where to find us on Instagram at JoyfullyBLK, and of course, shoot us an email. And that's our show, folks. Remember, if you're in the Charlotte, North Carolina area, or just want an excuse to visit Charlotte, register for the upcoming Joyfully Black and Civically Self-Care Salon event. You heard the ad in the beginning of today's episode. I'm co-hosting a salon event with Civically Inc., which is great. And so this salon event, as in salon, the fancy way of us saying a social gathering for connection and conversation with guest speakers on topics including financial wellness, updating your self-care practices, and more. So this event is on Saturday, April 27th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Charlotte's first self-care space designed for Black women, Afro space. So really excited about that. So you can register today at bit.ly/selfcareapril. That's bit.ly/selfcareapril. And the link is also on the Joyfully Black IG page. So we'd love to see you and bring a friend too. Okay? Until next time, stay in the black. Hey there, lovely listeners. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Joyfully Black. I hope that you're enjoying our content as much as we love creating it for you. So if today's episode has resonated with you or you find it valuable, please do us a favor and hit that subscribe button. It ensures that you never miss an episode and helps us reach more listeners like you. So if you've got a friend who loves what we're talking about today, don't keep it a secret. Sharing is caring after all. Send them a link and spread the word. And last but not least,
We truly value your thoughts and feedback. Whether it's a topic you'd like us to cover or thoughts on today's discussion, drop a comment or send us a message on joyfullyblk.com or on Instagram. Your voice matters, and it really helps shape the future of our show. Remember, this podcast grows and thrives because of listeners like you. So subscribe, share, and speak up. Until next time, stay in the black, y'all.